Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, by EverySite.com, the coolest new technology around. RunCatalina.com. Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $70 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. We've had over 800,000 downloads. Appreciate everybody's support. Our next guest is a two-time Ironman champion, a PhD, and the president of TriEqual. Sarah Gross joins us. Sarah, how are you?
Oh, I'm great, Bob. Thanks. How are you?
I am wonderful. So growing up, you were more of a soccer player, that type of thing?
Yeah, I played soccer at quite a high level until I was about 13. Actually, until my family moved to the Middle East. And then I took up some more individual sports just because it wasn't as common for to have high-level girls' soccer teams. So I took up some swimming and some running at that point.
And you moved to Abu Dhabi?
Yes. So we lived in the province of Abu Dhabi, but it's an inland city called Al Ain. Right near the border of Oman. So it's quite a small place, actually, that we moved to.
And moving to a place like that, and how old were you when you moved there?
I was 13. I think I had just turned 14.
Okay. And In terms of things that girls did in that country, I mean, I went to Abu Dhabi a couple of years ago and then went to Dubai and Bahrain, and I found that there really weren't a lot of sports for women.
Yeah, that's actually one thing now that I'm going to get to go back to the country, I'm hoping to explore more some of the opportunities for women and girls to play sports for locals. For me, as an expat, we did have lots of opportunities. I think the limiting thing for me, like when we talked about soccer just a minute ago, is that the level of sport wasn't as high.
Right.
So I was in a school with kids from all over the world, and we played soccer at a very high level. I was playing on a girls' team where we played, we went down to the States and we played big tournaments. And so when I got there, the other girls in my school certainly played soccer, but the level wasn't the same. So it was harder for me to find people to play with. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and you were in a small school, right, when you were over in the Middle East?
Yeah, it was a small school. It was just one class per grade. It was a Lebanese school called Shuifat, and it was run, it was run by Lebanese, but also lots of teachers from all over the Middle East, all over Europe as well. It's a really interesting experience because it was just so eclectic in terms of where everyone came from around the world.
When you have that type of experience, were you pretty isolated, or were you was your family involved with? A lot of times, when people are in international schools and their parents are diplomats, they're sort of isolated from the rest of the population. What was your experience like over there?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, and that's something that I really want people to understand in a way, or that I find hard to get across, is that we actually moved to the Emirates, and the Emirates is a very open society. So we just lived on a normal street, in a normal house, And we actually had a mosque right next door.
Wow.
Which was kind of annoying. My mom later moved to Saudi Arabia, and that was so different in terms of when I went to visit her there. She lived in a compound where there were just Westerners, and it's a completely different life. But for us at that time, we just, we wore what we wanted. We walked down the street. We talked to everybody. I mean, it's a completely open society, very normal, in normal, quote, unquote.
And how long were you there before you came back to Canada?
So I took a bit of a detour, but I did 10th grade and 11th grade there. And then I went to boarding school in Scotland to finish high school. And then I went to university in Canada and Edinburgh in Scotland, and in the meantime, my family stayed there that whole time. So I always came back for holidays, you know, when it was Christmas break, that's where I would go. And then eventually, when I took up triathlon, I met Ferris Alsultan,
who trained.
One of
our favorite guys.
Who trained, yes, who trained right there in the hotel where I would go to train. You know, there's only one place where people go to swim in the city we were in. So I eventually ended up spending sort of probably three months in the winter, and a lot of the time with Ferris just on bikes riding through the desert. So I came and went a lot over about, I'd say, 16, 17 years.
Well, it's interesting. When we were there for Abu Dhabi a couple of years ago, they had this Formula One track. And the guys who ran the Formula One track, and actually the bike ride was on the Formula One track, which was awesome. And talking to the guys who ran the Formula One track, they talked about how it is so difficult for people to find places to run or ride in the cities. So that they opened the track up on Tuesday night, and they would get like 3,000 people coming out on a Tuesday night, and they would have bikes available. And because the way they explained it to me, and you certainly would know better, is until a kid is 8 or 9 years old, it's all about, you know, being a kid. Then after that, it becomes education. And in terms of fitness, that goes away. And there's a huge problem with diabetes, huge problem with childhood obesity in that part of the world. And one of the things they're using the track for, which I was excited because it was basically triathlon giving back, was here's 3,000 people every Tuesday night, and then they had ladies' night every Wednesday night and get 1,000 women to do the same type of thing. Did you see that type of those type of issues while you were living there?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, you said a lot there. Yeah, I do see the obesity, diabetes issue that you can read about. You know, I saw how it was playing out in terms of the younger generation and the way that they, it's about the food, right? So
right.
They went from being sort of a nomadic tribal people, literally living in the desert,
right.
tent,
yeah.
to city living in about 30 years. And the introduction of Western foods and a lot of sugar. When I was there, by the time I was there in the 90s, you know, there's fast food restaurants everywhere, even in this small town where I lived. So, you know, the introduction of those foods so rapidly really messed with a lot of people's systems, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And that created a big part of the problem, plus the wealth, right? So it's suddenly there's access to, you know, people have access to, they can eat whatever they want, you know, they can drink as much Coke as they want. And so that was a problem. And then, yes, it's true that it's sort of a lot of Asian cultures also have that real academic focus.
Yes.
For better or for worse. And you see that kind of thing happening where people, kids really feel pressure for academic success and end up neglecting the physical side. So I did see that. And again, I think that sort of speaks to where we started with this, in that I came from Canada.
Right.
I'm in a class with kids all my age, but, you know, the only people who could match me athletically were the others who came from Western countries. You know, I remember there was an American girl who was pretty good at sport, but, you know, her and I could kick a ball, but that was about it.
Nobody else could.
Yeah.
So when did triathlon come into your life?
Triathlon came in when I was in university in Canada. I was running a little bit. I had also been swimming, and I volunteered for the local triathlon. So I actually checked in the elite athletes, and I remember Simon Whitfield coming up to the table, some of our elite athletes that I now know.
Yeah.
I checked in that day. I was in my early 20s, and I was just kind of floored by it. I had that kind of wow moment. This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. I have to do this. So that was how it came in. And then I just started. I just had to add cycling to my training. So
yeah, because you're already swimming and running, so you got 2 out of 3. You're
right.
Pretty much halfway, 3/4 of the way there. And exactly. Well, so 99, you bought a bike and started training.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I bought a bike and started, I don't know, you know what it's like at the beginning.
Sure.
Sort of you think you're training, but really,
yeah.
I was doing these little 40-minute bike rides.
You're going to the grocery store. You're like, hey, I got my basket on the front. I go for it. Yeah, I'm training now.
Exactly.
I'm ready. What was your first race?
Oh, it was that same race the next year.
The K-Town?
Yeah. The K-Town Tri. Yeah.
Yeah.
The classic.
And how'd you do?
Oh, I think, honestly, I think I was eighth in my age group.
Hey, first time out.
I'm pretty sure. Out of 23, I might add.
Oh, okay. But not that you don't know that. I like that. I was 8th out of 23. Not that I remember exactly
not
how
that I
was.
Really, exactly.
Yeah. But did you come away from that thinking, oh, this is pretty cool. I want to do more of these.
Yeah, I sort of thought, okay, I want to be good at this. You know, I thought, what are these people doing? That's when I really started to ask the questions. It wasn't just going out for a toodle ride around the block. You know, how do I get better at this? Because I could see, too, that I had swum and I had run pretty well, you know, at that point. So that made me question then, okay, can I do this? Can I do this better?
And when did you have the type of success that led you to believe, you know what, I could be a pro at this?
Oh, that didn't happen until I went to Scotland. I think part of it was being in the right place at the right time. So in Scotland, in Canada, we have a very competitive, at that time, we had a very competitive triathlon community.
Absolutely.
Where in Scotland, it was still, you know, it was still in its, you know, it was still a beginner.
Right, very new.
Of the sport.
Yeah.
Yes. So So when I went to triathlons in Scotland, I found I was placing very high in my age group and overall, and that kind of made me think, oh, maybe I could do this. And Darren Smith was coaching the national team then.
Yes.
And he had them away, I think, at a training camp, and I had won a race. And I remember thinking, okay, how can I go train with those guys? So I kind of figured out how to make that happen.
You seem like the type of person that you decide, okay, this is something I want to do. You just make sure it happens.
Great. I just, I actually got another coach who was, you know, who was a good coach, who was friends with Darren, and he helped me kind of talk my way onto the team.
Like it. And what'd you gain from that, from working with Darren Smith and his team?
The main thing with Darren is that he, as, you know, as quirky as he is, he always compares anyone who comes in the door to the best in the world, right? Which is sometimes hard to take because you end up, you know, I was kind of winning my age group, and I come to his camp, and he looks at me, and he says, "You're crap."
Oh, really? Know? That's always nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm like, "What? I'm not crap. At home, I did." Oh, but
I was top age grouper in Scotland at the Scotman Triathlon.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And so he, but once you realize that his paradigm is you're crap, at that time, I think the world champion was McKeely Jones.
Yes.
And so he's saying you're crap compared to McKeely Jones, which was absolutely true.
Well, and the fact that he's using you in the same sentence with McKeely Jones at that point is got to be like, wait a second, McKeely Jones? Oh, how did I get in that conversation?
Right. So, once you realize what he's working with in terms of parameters, you sort of, okay, well, that's fair. I'm crap. How do I bridge that gap? And that's the constant way that he was always dealing with the team. And you can see the success that he's had with his team now. A lot of it comes from that mindset from him, is that how are we going to get from where we are to the best? Which a lot of people, I think people shy away from that. People tend to think, oh, well, let's just be better for me, you know, that kind of thinking.
What I love is probably today, somewhere in the world, Darren Smith saying, "You are crap compared to Sarah Gross." He's probably ruining somebody else's day and going, well, wait a second. She's won two Ironmans. I'm in the same sentence as her. You know he's doing that.
Yeah, I hope so. I think he's probably more using Daniela.
You think?
Yeah.
That is funny. So talk about the race where after it you knew, okay, I can really be good at this.
Oh,
or has that happened yet?
Yeah, right. Hey, I'm waiting. Still waiting.
Yeah.
There were a couple things that happened. I started, when I was in Scotland, I started sort of training. I was training with the boys, really. I was kind of run with the boys, drink with the boys kind
of
person.
Yeah.
Always trying to keep up. And then I would train with people and do the same workouts that they did as part of our, you know, university triathlon team. And then I would go to the race and do, you know, usually better than the other people I was training with. That kind of made me think, okay, you know, maybe there's something to this. I did well in a marathon in about 2001. And then I won the Scottish Sprint Championships.
There you go.
That helped a lot. And there were a couple of kind of quasi-elite athletes there. So that was a bit of it. The breakthroughs came slowly but surely for me.
I was going to say, because you're talking, what, you win Ironman Brazil and Tremont in both in 14.
Right. Yeah, it took a while.
I was going to say, so it was a process. Was there a point there where you thought, gosh, I don't know if this is going to happen?
Yes, absolutely. That's, you know, I was asked the other day if there was anything in triathlon I'm scared of.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, for a few years there, I just thought I was scared almost that I was going to finish my career with, you know, 20 plus top 10 finishes, a bunch of seconds, a bunch of thirds, and no win,
right.
You know, and it started to get to the point where it felt almost risky to compete because the level of heartbreak that I have to deal with after if I didn't have a good race was just increasing as the years went on. So those two wins in 2014, obviously it just meant so much to me to finally be able to do that.
Well, and especially when you're talking an Ironman race, you're going to Ironman Brazil and Mount Tremblant, especially winning in Canada must have been great for you.
Yeah, absolutely. That was an amazing day. I was on, when I was on the run,
yeah.
The lead cyclist just kept saying, Sarah Gross, Première Canadienne, you know, and everybody would cheer. And
yes.
I love that she was calling out that I was the first Canadian and that got the reaction. You know, that was a really cool time.
Was it one of those races where you were, you know, you were leading for a big chunk of it, or did you have to come from behind to win it? How did it play out?
Oh, in Mont Tremblant, I actually had mechanical on the bike. So I had done a lot of hard work on my cycling because it continued to be sort of my weakness over the years. And, you know, I was finally starting to feel strong on a hilly course like Mont Tremblant. And, I had a mechanical that set me back. And when I got off the bike, I think I was 7 minutes back.
Wow.
And I thought I was going to be further back, actually, just because of all the problems I had had. But just because the way that who was there on the day and the way the race played out, I was 7 minutes back. But when they said 7 minutes, you know, I thought, okay, I can do this, you know, and I just started ticking away. So I didn't finally, it was, what's her name? I'm sorry, I'm losing her name. She won Lake Placid that same year. Amber Ferreira,
okay.
Who was leading, and I didn't catch her until 31Ks. So
wow.
It was quite far in, yeah.
So you still had plenty of time to celebrate, though. Or were you worried about somebody else might be coming?
Yeah, there's a little runner called Beth Shute. She's
yeah.
She was looking really good out there. So you never, and you know with Ironman, you never
yeah.
know. Because especially in those final miles, you feel like you're on the edge of just falling apart. So, you know, you're just trying to keep yourself together and hope for the best.
So when you win, when you have a year like that that you had in 2014, where you win two Ironman events in 1 year, and before that you had doubts that, gosh, I want to finish my career with winning something mm. major. How did that change your perception of you?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, it kind of made me relax a little bit. It sort of legitimated the journey for me.
Yeah.
You know, and,
sure.
and it's not all about winning. You know, I think I could have walked away from my triathlon career eventually satisfied with what I accomplished without the wins, but certainly the wins helped to legitimate how I had been spending my time over
right.
over a decade,
yes.
right?
Yeah, right. You're a PhD, right? So you're going, okay. And then what did your family think about this, this sort of distraction from academia? That you're okay. I'm off traveling the world racing.
Yeah, my family. You know, I'm so lucky. My husband is so supportive, and he's been in triathlon since the '80s as well.
Oh my God! Since the Earth was cooling.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's a fossil.
He was one of the original guys.
Oh
yeah.
My God! Wow, what's he thinking?
So he's a triathlon coach. That's what he does full time. You know, so we're in the sport. We run a club here in Victoria. So everything that I'm doing in my life fits with what we're working on as a team. So I'm really lucky to have that. Also, because I was in it so long, I had some really good sponsors and good relationships with my sponsors just over the years. which really helped too. So I didn't have to sit in poverty, you know, like I did at the beginning. You know, I joined the sport at a time when you could get sponsorship off the back of a third place Ironman finish or something like that, and then I just built those relationships. So I had a stable base for my training, basically.
Now, so when did TriEqual come around? What was the motivation for that?
Right. So TriEqual started when there was a group of us who first started talking about the issue around 50 Women to Kona, which had been initiated first by Rachel Joyce, sort of bringing up that issue with the press, and then another woman who started the Twitter handle at 50 Women to Kona, just because, and this is a great story, she was just sitting in her living room one day and literally thought, there should be equal numbers of men and women. I wonder if anyone agrees with me. So she started the Twitter handle just to kind of find out if people were thinking about that issue. And we all started to talk and to sort of brainstorm. There was a group of 12 of us people who had been vocal. I wrote a series of articles for What's Up.
Right.
So I had already started that process. So we found each other, you know, the people who had been vocal on this. And then we decided that on International Women's Day, we were going to, you know, show the kind of support that we had via social media. So that was how we kind of launched that. And then TriEqual was formed after that because we realized that we were all committed both to that cause but also to other things, you know, regarding our sport and equity, not just women, but some other issues that we all wanted to address. So that's how we just decided to take it forward.
When I look at the history of the sport, and like your husband, I go back to the dark ages as well, and you look at Lynn LeMaire, the first woman to do Ironman in 1979, and she was fifth overall and actually led on the bike for a while. Our sport has been guided by strong women from the very beginning, Valerie Silk, Sharon Eccles, Diana Birch, Paulina B. Frazier. I mean, you think of our sport, and one of the things that was very important, Sally Edwards, who was such a mobilizing force for making sure we had equal prize money from the very beginning in the sport of triathlon. So did it surprise you knowing that our roots were, you know, equality? We'd always had equality. I was not even aware at that point that we had, you know, 50 men qualified to go to Kona and only 35 women. To me, it just didn't make sense. It was one of those things you looked at and said, there's got to be a rationale here that I can't see.
Yeah, it's surprising, but it didn't. So a lot of what I did for the What's Up articles was look into a lot of that history, how we got, how we became such an equal sport, tried to pull out some of the amazing stories from that. So that was a big part of my learning process, too, just to know all that and who all the players were. I loved your interview with Sally Edwards, by the way. I listened to
Wasn't
that.
Wasn't she great?
She's amazing.
She is amazing. And she's been, you know, and Sally was, obviously, she's a trailblazer for a woman owning a retail store, for women in business and women in sport. If you're talking about that, your leaders in that, Sally Edwards is right at the top of that list.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And in terms of being surprised about 50 Women to Kona, I don't, or the lack of 50 Women to Kona.
Yeah.
I don't think I really am, in a way, just because of the way everything's played out with Ironman being sold a number of times, and now corporate interests are sort of running that show in a way.
Right.
And that, you know, when you look at sport as a whole, and this is another thing that I've been doing quite a bit of, is looking at, you know, where inequality comes in, gender inequality in sport comes in, it's always down to corporate interests. You know, in places where they want to focus on what is good and equitable, like the Olympic movement, there's always efforts made to increase the number of women, to have equal number of women at the Olympic Games, or at with individual sporting federations are always trying to, you know, improve the lot of women and other underrepresented groups. Right, that's one of their focuses. But when you have corporate interests, you know, if the extreme example is like the Super Bowl, you know, how far are we from having a women's Super Bowl that's equal to the current Super Bowl? I mean, it's miles, right? And I think we're seeing a little bit of that in our sport too. That's just how it happens when money becomes involved.
When I look at the equality, and one of the things that Andrew Messick and I talked about was, I mentioned that, you know, when you had women's tennis issue, when Venus Williams came out and said, why don't we not have equal prize money? I mean, the women are, even though we play three sets rather than five, but we're as big a draw as the men are, so we should have equal prize money, and equal prize money came about. So it seems like a lot of times when things are pointed out, people realize that, oh, okay, world has changed. We need to change with it. Have you been surprised that Ironman really – now, from this, I think one of the positive sides of this, all of a sudden the initiative came out from Ironman, and I think they've done some really nice things. When you look at that, do you look at the Woman to Try as sort of a byproduct of Try Equal? Is that something that was created almost to say, okay, we need to do something here. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah, I think yes and no. Yeah, I don't think it's a direct byproduct of TriEqual, but I think that recognizing that there needs to be some kind of committee that addresses, you know, what the women have to say directly by Ironman. I think that was happening. It's pretty tough, you know. It's pretty tough with the Women for Tri Board because we've had some trouble even being able to communicate about this 50 Women to Kona issue with them. And I love a lot of the things that they're doing. And I've
yes.
talked to a number of members of the board. And, you know, it's quite amicable between us, you know. But this becomes the issue that we can't talk about for some reason.
I got it. And it seems like that would be the solution, right, where Women to Try and TriEqual sit down to talk about how to deal with the initiatives.
Right, yes. That would be part of it for sure. I'm not sure how much say they would get in that with the power that be at Ironman.
Right.
I don't know really how that works. But, you know, I would love to sit down with the Women for Tri Board. And, you know, we, TriEqual, may end up at some point.
So when one of the things that from people I've talked to is they'll say, hey, it's great to try to get – we have 35 women qualifying to go to Kona right now and 50 men. The pro women need to fill up all the fields, right? We've got races around the world, Ironman races, where we'll have prize money 10 deep and we'll only have 7 pro women there. So they need to step up and start filling up the fields and showing that – there's enough pro women out there to really make the 50 women to Kona make sense. Is there?
Yeah.
How do you go answer that?
Yeah, I actually think that expecting the women to step up is utterly unfair in a way. When we're dealing with, you know, a historical context where women have been excluded from sport largely mm-hmm. until, you know, the first woman to women to run Boston are still alive. So
right. yep.
it just shows you how little endurance sport has been part of women's lives and for what short period. Now, obviously, triathlon managed to avoid that a little bit. But I really think that to turn around, you know, and say to not provide equal opportunity and then turn around and say it's up to you guys to show you deserve it is just wrong, in my opinion.
Right.
I think that opportunity precedes the depth in the field, and that will come, and that it will be slow. I mean, it was in the ITU, you know, they provided the opportunity, and even when I started triathlon, I remember ITU fields with 3 and 4 women.
Right, that's right? True, yeah.
And now the ITU fields at the top races are equal, the depth is equal.
Right.
And so, in a way, that seems like it's a short time, long time, you know. It might take a decade, but provide the opportunity, show us that you respect us and our performances, and then, you know, people will start coming to the races.
Love that. Well, it's very true. Mm-hmm. In the early days of ITU, there were not a lot. And you think about it, when Joan Benoit ran and won the gold medal in 1984 at the Olympic marathon, that was the first time women allowed to run a marathon in the Olympics.
Right.
That's not that long ago.
Right.
So,
yeah, 1984.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and we had the same type of thing with, I think the longest distance for women for longest time was 800 meters, right, in the Olympics. So, you know, the over time, the 5 and 10 had to be added in the 80s.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's there's terms of opportunities, a lot of those have been late coming. So talk a little bit about over time. We've had Tri Dubai. We've had teams, you know, Abu Dhabi. Now we have the Bahrain Endurance 13 team that you just became a member of. Over time, and I always felt from talking to Ferris, that was one of the reasons they were creating those teams. Ferris al-Sultan was on one of the teams, and I remember Norman Stadler being on the Tri Dubai along with Tim DeBoom. And their whole idea was to draw attention to that part of the world and to some of the challenges in that part of the world. What did you know about those teams before the whole Bahrain team came about?
Yeah, so I've been totally intrigued by those teams. You know, obviously I know Ferris fairly well and was glad to see him, you know, taking leadership on an Abu Dhabi team. What I know from being in the Middle East is that the interest in endurance sport is massive.
Right.
So when I was there, I would go there for the winter to Al Ain, and it would often be the case where a sheikh would decide that he wanted to see, you know, an endurance sport. There was one year a sheikh put on 8 races. Every 2 weeks, there was either a running race, a bike time trial, a triathlon, or duathlon, right? So they just rolled through those things. He put a ton of prize money on it, and it was equal for men and women, you know? So I would, during my training, just be able to show up at these races, and local people who coming from all over the world, you know, would show up and do these races. So there's a lot of that, and that happens every year. You know, there used to be a bike race up the Jebel, which is, Jebel just means mountain. So there's one mountain in the Emirates, and it's 10K climb. It's amazing. A super highway up the side of a mountain. And someone just decided, I want to race here, put a ton of prize money on it, and there's a race from the bottom of the mountain to the top. So these kinds of things I've seen on small ways and in bigger ways with the full teams. And it's something I've always wanted to be involved in because I felt like I could talk about this, you know, this is a way I could sort of go to the Middle East and be, you know, be part of a team where I understand the culture. I'm completely comfortable there. I'm happy to talk to, you know, the local people, but I also, you know, felt like I could speak to some of the Western misconceptions about what's, you know, happening. And so, and because again, we talked about how I didn't win Ironman until 2014, I didn't have a high enough profile in the sport to really be called up to one of those teams. So now we have the exception with Bahrain, and I had been talking to the communication manager from Bahrain for a long time just about a way, you know, we were looking for a way to try to make me part of the conversation. So I wanted to go over to the training camp over there, see what was going on, talk to some of the locals, do some interviews. These are the things I really wanted to do. And then eventually they just came back to me with a 1-year contract that was for racing and some media work as well. So it was pretty exciting, actually, how that actually finally happened. To answer your question, after years of kind of watching this happen and feeling a little bit like, honestly, that the dialogue that could take place there wasn't really happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, because I think you know, the people who are members of the team, they're athletes, right? And
right.
Not to say that you're not, but you're more than an athlete. There's if you're talking Sebastian Keenlane and Jan Frodeno and Daniela Reef, they're not political animals. They're not the ones who are going to go out there and make big statements, because you're looking to win races too, but I think you understand that your purpose is beyond just winning races. When you become part of the Bahrain Endurance 13 team, something else that comes along with it is Bahrain and the Sheikh have a history that's if you Google the Sheikh, you see abuse, you see human rights issues. How did you balance that when they came to you and said we'd like you to be part of our team?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, honestly, I didn't even feel really like balance was necessary. I think that a lot of those, that accusations, first of all, are always accusations. So following them blindly was not going to be something that I was going to do. Also, if you read, I mean, a lot of the people who are really critical of His Highness and the things that he's supposedly done, I mean, a lot of them would do well, I think, to dig in a little bit and find out what the story is. So it's pretty, I don't know, there's a lot of political issues going on there. And so, you know, there was these accusations brought against him in the UK. And the question was, at the time when it came out, whether or not he had diplomatic immunity because of the relationship between Britain and Bahrain. Okay, so right now Bahrain is politically, and I don't want to talk about politics too much, but I'll just tell you what I know. Politically, sure. They are geographically located in this amazing place where sort of between Saudi and Iran, you know, and in terms of, if we're going to talk about Middle East peacekeeping, having an ally plopped right there where they are for Britain, for the U.S., is really, really important. And you can imagine how important that is, you know, now, these days, with, you know, with everything that's happening, with, you know, the turmoil that is spreading across the Middle East in a way. So that's the backdrop to this. So someone takes an accusation to the British courts. They have to decide whether he has immunity. And basically, they decided he had immunity, right? And then they said, in Britain, they said, okay, so bring us your evidence. Let's take him to court, right? And at that point, nothing else happened. So there was no
evidence. There was an accusation, but no follow-up.
Right. So there was an accusation, yes. But once it was like, okay, you know, we open the doors to you, bring it to court, right? And then nothing.
And so there really hasn't been any follow-up of any sort from the people who made the accusations.
Right. And so that, now, again, I'm not going to comment on what's true or not. I'm not trying to absolve anybody of anything. And I don't know. But
right.
What's happening in the court, I mean, that you have to go with that, right? I mean, if the courts can't even, if they can't even get a trial together, I can't be judge and jury over someone. You know,
it was interesting. I remember when the Sheik came to the U.S. to race Ironman Florida, and it was a big backlash. People saying, "I can't believe Ironman's allowing this group of people to do Ironman Florida." And I'm sitting there going, "Well, really, it's if he has a passport and is allowed into this country, who has the right to tell somebody they can't do something? It's really up to the government to tell." To basically say this person is not allowed in this country because of human rights issues. Once they're there, then it's not up to an organization, any organization, to tell somebody they can't participate in an event.
Right, exactly. And I really object to this idea that because he's such a high-profile person, you know, that those kind of accusations almost stick in a way that maybe they shouldn't or they wouldn't if he wasn't so high-profile. And then that, you know, people get to hang. It's too convenient that he's such a high profile, you know, Arab Muslim person who's partially in charge of a country. It's a narrative that I just refuse to follow. You know, it's sort of, let's talk about the broader context of this. Let's figure out what's going on in the Middle East. Let's talk about all of these things. But A, it does nothing to a triathlon. And, you know, B, we're just not experts, right? Let politics happen where politics happen. And again, I mentioned the relationship between Britain and Bahrain and also between the U.S. and Bahrain, because a lot of the nature of this dialogue is directed, and what's said and not said is directed by how politically what people are allowed to say and not. You know,
what's intriguing to me is because you grew up there or spent time, obviously, have spent a lot of time there, that and knowing that obviously you're a very bright person, you would do your research before connecting your brand to this brand. And and I'm sure that this was not just a, hey, thanks for the offer, I'm in. Was it a process for you?
Oh yeah, it was a huge process. Actually, I was just thinking back how on Christmas Day I was once all the you know we did our meal on Christmas Eve and then Christmas morning and then once all that dust settled, I actually spent I don't know probably 7 or 8 hours. I mean, and this was not the only time I researched this, but and I remember thinking, wow, this is sad on Christmas Day.
Yeah, right.
I'm researching about the political situation in Bahrain.
Yes, right.
You know. But I really did want to understand it as much as possible and know what was out there. And I also am really lucky because I have contact with our local university here. So they've opened all their, you know, everything's online now. When you go to university, you don't go to the library. You just log in.
Right.
And all the articles and books are there. And so I could log in and find all the academic research on Bahrain, both historically and the current political context. It was really easy for me to find all the social media accounts of who's saying what in this situation. So I feel like I have a pretty broad view of, you know, of what's happening, and I know what I'm getting into, and I know that a triathlon team that's aiming to try to help the people of Bahrain, again, back to the obesity, diabetes,
yes.
You know, that can only be a good thing. You know, that the money that's coming in and then in turn being, you know, passed down to the Bahrain team, the opportunities that are being provided are, you know, are really, really important. And that's a process that I really want to be part of. And it shows something, I think, from the team that they were willing to, you know, take on even someone like me who isn't necessarily going to go and win Kona next year, right? But that has that I have that piece that I want to go and I want to talk about these things.
Well, obviously, when they bring someone like yourself in, they're not bringing you in to say, "Don't talk about what's going on here." That's not it, right? So they're basically saying, Sarah, we want Sarah Gross, who the person who started TriEqual, the person who's going to ask questions, so that as well as being an athlete. So, you know, to a certain degree, that gives the team Bahrain Endurance some credibility, from my perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I hope that I can speak well to what they're trying to do. And from the TriEqual point of view, I also hope that the things that I'm doing, I'm going to Dubai at the end of the month for the 70.3.
Yep.
And I'm on a relay team with a couple of locals. I've also set up a couple of interviews with women from Bahrain and Saudi Arabia who do triathlon. And so I hope to, you know, be able to bring those women's voices to light too, because I know from being there that once you're talking to these women, they're just like us.
Right.
You know, they just get up in the morning and train. They do this thing. It's the combined or the shared experience is really large. And I also want to ask them about, you know, the perceptions in their world about women in sport and how, you know, I don't know everything about what it's like to be a woman in the Middle East doing sport, about, you know, whether people in your family would be critical about that or not. I have no idea. So I want to find out those things and be able to talk about them. And that's something that's really important to me.
Love it. Hey, Sarah, yeah. Thanks so much for taking so much time. Congratulations on being part of the Bahrain Endurance 13 team. Very, very exciting. And so will that be you'll be on a relay team at Ironman Dubai?
Yes. So relay team at Ironman Dubai. And then I'm just, because I broke my foot sort of late last year, so I'm just trying to get my fitness back, and I will be racing later in the year.
Love it. Sarah Gross has been our guest. Sarah, thanks so much for taking time.
Thanks, Bob. I really appreciate it.
We, again, are brought to you by Ironman U, by EverySite.com, RunCatalina.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation, and check us out on Babbittville or on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.